Hello, and welcome to the Business of Information Security podcast with me, Gareth Becker. In this podcast, we chat to senior cybersecurity executives from a range of industries about their passions, experiences, and challenges. Without further ado, let's go ahead and dive straight into today's episode. Welcome to the Information Security podcast, and we are recording live at CISO London. It's our first in-person event since the pandemic kicked off, so it's very exciting, and I'm very pleased to have joining me Goa Mohammed. And how are you doing today? How are you finding the experience?
Yeah, good to see you, Gareth. And yeah, it's been really it's been nice actually. It's a bit strange because we've been sort of in lockdown and working behind screens for so long. It's yeah, it feels odd, but it actually feels kind of natural as well. You kind of fall back into it, and it's actually nice to see people face to face, that interaction, that organic discussion that happens just naturally when you're with people compared to a screen, which always feels a bit staged. So yeah, it's great, really enjoying it. It's really nice to be seeing people again.
Yeah, I completely know what you mean. It was somewhat surreal for me just coming back into a city, to be perfectly honest, but yeah. You know, glad to do it for sure. So just for the benefit of our listeners, I was just wondering if you could introduce yourself briefly and let us know what you're up to.
Yeah, of course. So I'm Group Head of Information Security at LNQ. So LNQ is one of the UK's, if not the largest housing association builder actually in the UK. We turn over just over $1 billion a year, but we're worth about $45 billion. So we're a very large organisation. And for my sins, I look after all things information and cybersecurity. I've been working in technology as a technology leader since 2004, so a fair while now. Seen kind of all things from Sarbanes-Oxley to ISO 27001 standards to PCI, you name it. I've been involved there, stood it up, and it's been great. And where I am now is just the next iteration of kind of what I've been doing. Started off as Greenfield, so it was just me and one other person doing information security. We've grown the team out to a team of five plus a wider squad, but we're looking to grow the immediate team out by another four. So we're on a great journey to really just improve all aspects of InfoSec.
Yeah, great. And you were speaking on a panel earlier on, and the subject of that panel was ransomware, its evolution, perhaps where it's headed. We've seen a real, over the last few years, a real, you know, the attackers taking on an almost corporate approach in terms of, you know, we've got ransomware as a service, we've got a really, you know, it's developed a lot. So where do you see it heading from here?
I think it's a good question. And to be honest with you, I don't think anyone really knows, because ransomware, if we'd known about ransomware 5 years before it actually became a thing, we probably would be in a better place than where we are right now. I think where we are going forward, I think it's going to continue to evolve and adapt. So, you know, ransomware existed in the 1980s, which I think I mentioned in the panel, which was floppy disk was sent to someone. It was meant to be some kind of AIDS research. Someone plugged it in, it encrypted their files on their machine, and they were asking for the, you know, they could give the code if they paid them some of money. So I think it's always going to be around. It's the mechanism and how people do that. So at the moment, if you think about it, people are targeting the environments. Companies are getting better, so they're trying to make sure they have better backups, which they can fail over to. If you think about it, if I think one of the people mentioned that it's shifting left in terms of how attackers are trying to do bad things. Well, what may evolve is they may go for the backup sites and the DR sites and start attacking those. So it's like, it's not just about we're attacking your environment and bringing you down. We're gonna remove, first of all, the capability for you to fail over. Mm. You know, so there's gonna be iterations, and we'll see what happens. But I think as professionals in the industry, we need to think about how do we have layers of defense to protect bad things from happening. So almost like an onion, to get to the center of it, you need to peel back the layers, if you can stop it at the each layer or earlier in that chain, then you're going to be in a better place. So that's, for me, kind of where we should be looking at.
I definitely like to get into some of that you just mentioned. And I just want to come to something that you said. You know, if we're looking at that early stage, especially, you know, in terms of actual prevention, there's something you said in the talk about you really placing a lot of value in visibility and in people. So yep. I just want to ask you about what that means to you.
Of course. Visibility is really important. I think it can't be underestimated, because you don't know where you're headed, or you don't know where you are if you can't see where you are, if that makes sense. So, and visibility can come through tooling, it can come through people, it gives you the contextual understanding of what your environment looks like. Because I think I mentioned we operate first and second line blend. Historically, information security was a second line function, which was providing oversight and making sure people did their job. That shifted in a big way, because you can't provide that. It becomes very hard to prescribe what needs to be done when you don't know what it looks like on the ground for the people who are doing it and how the challenges they're coming across. So it's important to work in that blend. Then you get the oversight, and that gives you an understanding of your threat landscape and the risks that are posed to your organization. Once you have that visibility, that gives you the opportunity to then leverage that and move in a direction where you can then say, okay, this is what the world looks like going forward. This is where we need to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you can do that is through people, because you can automate the hell out of everything if you really wanted to. And automation's great. You know, I'm a big advocate of it. But automation comes in when people are doing the same thing over and over again. So if you're doing patching and you're doing patching all the time, doing the same thing on a cycle, what elements of that can you automate?
Yeah.
You know, and it's nailing those. And once you do that, then you go on that journey. But you can only do that if you can see, and that's through SIEM tools, it's through EDR, it's through proactive monitoring, having a team that really understands what the daily challenges are.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And there was another question there during the talk about controls and the really, key controls that you have in order to be able to try and mitigate some of the risks, you know, in the event of a successful ransomware attack. So what do you think about that? What are some of the key things that you think about there?
So I think having been through a situation, I think it's communication and working across the organization as quickly as possible is critical with that. When you're in that situation, it's no longer a technology problem, it's a business problem, and the business needs to continue to operate. They need to continue to do what they need to do, service their, you know, customers, in our case, our residents, where I am, but, you know, customers, clients, whoever it is, investors. Investors are potentially losing millions of pounds, companies losing millions of pounds, et cetera, et cetera. So it becomes a, what does a business do to make sure it continues to operate and turn over the money or provide that service it needs to, or make sure there's, I think it was mentioned, there's a threat, potential threat to life in certain jobs and organizations. So the business needs to make a call, and there needs to be that contingency plan. Do you go back to pen and paper temporarily to ensure you do that? In terms of your customers, if your customers are impacted, if their data has been dumped somewhere or their data has gone missing or has fallen into the wrong hands, it's our obligation to make sure we let them know, which is a very, and you know, being in that situation, we took a bit of a radical approach to that. And actually, we went out and said, we need to inform our customers as soon as we know what's happened. We're not going to wait until the ICO tells us what to do, or the investigation has gone through to its final form and we know where we are. If we know something has happened, we need to let our customers know this is where we are. And actually, that then reduces the risk of impact, fraud, all the bad things that can happen to them. That reduces that risk, because ultimately that's why we exist as an organization, to service them. And when you have that discussion, yes, there are going to be people that are unhappy, but the fallout is much less, because at least they appreciate the heads up. And I'm not sure about you, Gareth, but for myself, I'd rather know, and then I'll be like, thank you for letting me know. I'll make sure if someone does try and commit fraud against me, I know that it might be because of this, and I'll be in a better position, rather than finding out 6 months later and I've been getting loads of phone calls and I've already given my life savings away because I've clicked on a phishing link that's landed with me because they know about me.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, there's a real risk in terms of a reputation, I suppose, you know, in dealing with a problem. And certainly we hope that you never, or as professionals, we never have to be in that position. But to the company overall, there's a big reputational risk when it comes to dealing with these things badly.
Well, and this is the thing, the reputation is the hardest thing to recover from. I think the immediate financial impact is not ideal. You know, I think, you know, having a GDPR fine potentially, or data protection fine, which everyone keeps calling it GDPR, is a problem, but you can recover from that financially over a period of time, or you can cover that through cyber insurance or whatever mechanism that is. But the reputation, if it's so damaging that the customer or the client or the resident or whoever it is can't trust the organization, that is something that is going to be a depleting problem, that you will always have a financial impact. And you know, you see that with organizations. I mean, without quoting Facebook, but actually Facebook are still recovering from the challenges they've had from a privacy standpoint. You know, they're still trying to make up that reputational trust that they've suffered from. And, you know, we don't know what that's going to look like, but it's still a struggle for them. And that's, you know, for us, a massive lesson learned for every organization. Reputation is a big, big problem.
Yeah. You mentioned their cyber insurance. This is also something that was talked about a little bit during the talk earlier on. And the question was put fairly arrestingly, is it worth the paper it's written on? What do you think?
It's a really tough one. I think, you know, it's hard to pinpoint exactly the value of cyber insurance until you've actually been there. So I haven't had to invoke cyber insurance. Where I am and where I've worked with my director of risk is that we should make sure we have the capability to provide what cyber insurance would. And that could be done internally. You know, you can have the team that responds to cyber incidents. You can have your partners with external providers that can give you that response should you need it, if you're overwhelmed or don't know where to go, if it's too much for the internal capabilities. So it's the assurance, ultimately. If you've got enough assurance internally, then I think you're in a good place. Mm-hmm. If you don't have the assurance internally, then get cyber insurance. But there is a tipping point where it may be more cost effective to build your team internally rather than paying the insurance. It may be that you can't afford that, but you can pay the insurance. So it's a risk management piece that each organization needs to do. But there needs to be a much better framework that they operate within, because at the moment it's a little bit disjointed. Everything is done by each insurance company, depending on what they feel they're confident in. And, you know, interesting story. I know someone who was saying that they were studying their MSc in information security, and they were speaking to someone and they were saying that person was a insurance person trying to learn cybersecurity to understand what are the clauses, what are the ins and outs of information security. Without saying so, the person was also saying that they're looking for ways that they don't have to pay as well, potentially.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very interesting insight, but also, you know, it is really a case of leverage what your risk appetite is, and from that you say that you make a decision whether you need cyber assurance or not.
Yes. I mean, I suppose they are operating a different kind of business themselves.
Absolutely. And they've got different things they want to gain from that.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the other things we touched on before was regards to cryptocurrencies. Obviously, this is a very popular way of, you know, ransoms being demanded in cryptocurrencies. Do you think that more extensive regulation of that sector would help to effectively reduce instances of ransomware, or do you think it would just move on to something else?
It it definitely will move on to something else, because criminals will, they don't really care how they get paid, as long as they get paid.
Mm.
If cryptocurrency is the way they can get paid right now, fantastic. I'm sure they'll be happy about that. But if it was another mechanism, another form of currency that isn't crypto, it could be, you know, offshore accounts or whatever it is, it will be done in that way. It could be assets. You know, we see laundering in so many ways, right? So what's going to happen is cryptocurrency will not dictate ransomware. Ransomware will dictate what, how they get paid, or not ransomware, sort of ransom and cyber criminals will dictate what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
It's down to us to say, well, we're not going to negotiate or we're not going to bargain. But that will always come down to the business. If the business are like, we've got no option but to pay the ransom because we're now at a point where it's having an impact on us, it's having an impact on what we do, they'll pay the money.
Absolutely. And so just to wrap up, I think if I was going to ask you for one piece of advice that you would give to a cybersecurity executive on how to, there's one thing that you can do to kind of try to protect your business from the worst kind of harm that can be inflicted from a ransomware attack, what would you say?
It's really, really hard to give one, but I think if there's one thing, is get your basics right. Do your baselines, get your baselines right. Everything will fall on top of that, if that makes sense. So if you're doing your basic hygiene, your patching, your getting people in place to look after the kind of the basic processes and the tools that you have, get that baseline right. Everything then goes on top of that, because there's always complexity. If you try and do everything at once, you're never going to get there. If you try and do all things at the same time, you're never going to get there. You can throw money at the problem, but there's a lot of other things that come into place. But if you can get the main things that you can control, so your technology solutions, your processes across the business, engagement with at exec level, make sure that they buy into it, not just pay lip service to it, then you're on a great journey, and that's a great starting point. And then from there you build. But don't try and do it all at once, because it won't happen.
Right. Well, thank you very much for joining me. I appreciate the time.
No worries. Thanks, Gareth. Pleasure speaking to you.
Thanks once again to Goa Mohammed for joining me for this episode of the Business of Information Security podcast. I'd like to finish today's episode by leaving you with a recording from CISO London with Glenn Hymers. Glenn is the head of data privacy and compliance for the Cabinet Office, and he was also the chairperson for our CISO London event. In this clip, he's speaking to my colleague, Catherine King.
Glenn, thank you so much for joining me here today. Now, I'm really keen to pick your brains. Given that you are within government, I am keen to know how COVID-19 impacted your information security strategy, because I'm pretty certain it must have.
So, I mean, to be fair, I can't talk much to what government did, as I've only just joined government recently. But I can use the experience. I mean, it impacted the strategy because we went from working across the road from here in this lovely establishment to all being at home. And what does that look like? And how do you secure a government doing what government needs to do on a day-to-day basis when you've gone from very, very secure environments, both physically and IT-wise, to being in people's living rooms, being in people's kitchens, being in people's lofts? So there was a big push towards digital transformation, a lot more around the ability to use computers remotely as opposed to having to be connected to the virtual networks and all those types of stuff. So, yeah, so it's pushed forward everything by about 10 years, and which is not an uncommon theme. Where I was prior to going to government, it did exactly the same thing. But luckily, we were set up for it. What governments had to embrace is the whole hybrid and change of not everybody being in the office all of the time.
And I mean, that's the question I wanted to follow up on. Was this completely brand new? Because I'm assuming that most people were completely in the office and then completely remote, as opposed to some organizations here today and others will have had that kind of flexible working. It wouldn't have been completely alien. Or was it the case that you had to go from hot to cold?
For the civil service, I would suggest it, and for government in general, it's a case of we've had to go from A to B, because government likes to work in offices. That is what they've done historically. The civil service is the same. yes, there's flexibility in some areas. For example, in my part-time, I work for the Ministry of Defence as well, and they've introduced a hybrid working environment, all those types of things. But that was pre-COVID, but wasn't greatly taken up on. But now it's sped that up, and it's more people are doing that flexible working now. So it's introduced that, not a culture, but a view that flexible working and hybrid working is something that we can now do and should, and probably for people's work-life balances, should be thinking about doing, because it's some people find they're more productive working at home than they do sitting in the office, and some people the other way around. So it's to butcher a saying, it's horses for courses, isn't it, really, I guess? And it's finding that nice niche balance for everybody to be able to perform to the best of their abilities, regardless of where they are.
Absolutely. Now, I appreciate you have not been in the role a long, long time, but you mentioned there about the strategic shift. Were you having to do things that you perhaps didn't think you'd be doing, in a sense of educating colleagues about being safe and stuff like that, that perhaps you would have done naturally, maybe, you know, occasionally across the months in the office, you know, reminding people to destroy documents safely, not clicking on links? But I suppose that had to be really escalated when you went remote, because there was an increase, as we know, in people trying to do these things. Yeah. What was that experience like?
So, I mean, I'll talk to what I did before at my previous place, and then I'll talk to what we do now, which is very, very similar, actually. The education and security awareness and data protection awareness and all those types of things, yes, the messaging's had to change. How you deliver that messaging's changed. We've gone from having face-to-face conversations with people to doing virtual meetings and being in those locations. We've had to rely on a lot around lunch bag learnings virtually and all those types of things. And it's getting that message out there about what they can and can't do. What does the acceptable use policy say around printing from home? Can you or can't you print from home? If you need to print from home, this is the kind of stuff you need to put. And it's got to be more bespoke to the actual individuals, as opposed to just, this is what we say you must do. So you have to tailor those programs to what the actual individuals are having to contend with, rather than, oh, yeah, that's what we say we do, therefore you shall do it. Because they might not be able to do that, or they might have a need to do something different. It's more around, we've had to tailor our awareness bits a little bit more than we would have done before, where we've just gone, there you go, that's the ivory tower says thou shalt do. Now it's a case of, well, we say you should do, but what's within the art of the possible for you to do your job?
So it's almost applying that human nature to it and saying, actually, we know this is kind of the gold tier, this is what we want you to be doing, but we know there's going to be certain situations that arise where you perhaps have to join using this software because an external client, but this is what you're going to do, and kind of almost categorize it. So how has this impacted your wider cultural strategy? Because I know, obviously, having people bought into this is the crux of it being a success and a failure. So what are you now looking forward towards doing to build on the successes that you have seen from educating people at home, and then going forwards? What's that looking like for you in terms of that hybrid mode you were saying there about, you know, depending on what people suits them? I'm assuming you're setting yourself up for perhaps not a full return to the office, but seeing what that looks like for people.
Yeah, I think the service is looking at the flexible models now. What is the expectation? How many days a week do people need to be in the office versus how many days a week could they not be in the office? The other rationale that comes with that is desk space. I mean, the infrastructure was crowded prior to the pandemic. The infrastructure is going to be just as crowded now, but with the requirement to put other COVID compliant type stuff in place. So we need to be making sure we address that, but we also then to be balancing that, the requirements of the individual with the balance of the organisation, and what does the organisation need to function. Primarily, at the end of the day, we're here to deliver for government. And yes, we can do that from home, but can we do that better from the office, or can we do that just as well from home? And it's finding that balance between the two. And I think there's going to be a bit of to-ing and fro-ing and back and forth on that. In regards to what we're going to do with regards to the awareness packages, is just embed what we've got and develop what we've got and develop out our champions networks, our data protection leads and our information security lead networks, building those out so it isn't reliant on, say, for example, the team that I head up, which is four people strong, to deliver for a whole department. We're going to start to build on that and build that out and do that. So that's kind of where my head is with that. And I think most people will be like that with regards to security awareness and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think that's probably where we're at.
Absolutely fantastic. Now, one last question I wanted to ask before I let you get back to the event here today is, what do you think has been, and your previous job, your current job, taking it all into account, what has been your main learning from the experience you've had over the last year?
People are key. We can't just rely on technology. The people, I mean, someone alluded to it earlier in one of the panels. If you've got processes, people will follow those processes. So you need to make sure that people understand the processes and they understand the policies. But more importantly, they understand what they're doing and how it impacts the organization. If it impacts the organization negatively, they need to understand that before they carry that out. And I think that's primarily where we're at. It's knowing that people are our last line of defense. They're not a problem. Picnic, problem in chair, not in computer. It might be a thing in IT support, but it shouldn't be a thing in IT security, and it shouldn't be a thing in data protection, because they're going to be the ones that either catch the phishing email that comes in, or they're the ones that are going to go, well, hang on a minute, should I be sharing that data in the first place? So I think it's educating our users and our end users well, so they can make those educated decisions.
Amazing. Well, Glenn, I will let you get back to the event. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed that episode of the Business of InfoSec podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you're currently listening to make sure you get our latest episodes. Plus, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please consider leaving us a review. As always, you can find us and engage with us on social media, as well as on the Business of InfoSec website, where you can find this podcast, as well as other topical articles, reports, and videos. So, until next time, take care.